Hello and welcome to The Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. The Filibuster refers to the right of unlimited debate in the world's greatest deliberative body, the U.S. Senate. And we are here. I am Seth Brake, and I'm joined by Sean Evans, the chair of the department and the professor of political science here. We're going to be discussing the Trump administration in some ways, but we aren't going to be unlimited in the same way that the U.S. Senate is when it talks about the filibuster, because we have places to be, things to do, so we will try and respect everyone's time here. But there is a lot to talk about because we have a new presidential administration, so I have some questions I'd love to ask you. But Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
So, new president, new administration, lots of new stuff going on. Before we get into specific questions, why don't you just give me 30 seconds on how should we feel about this?
Well, I think the best way to describe this is shock and awe. I mean, everyone expected him to take executive action, but I think people are surprised at the depth of the kinds of things that he is trying to do, and that he is trying to uproot decades of progressive governance.
Yeah.
And the concern, or the hope, depending upon your perspective, is what are going to be the long-term impact of this, not just for government, but for presidential power.
Well, we can get into all that, but maybe before we jump into the long-term impact, you say executive action. Is that the same thing as an executive order? What is an executive action?
No. So when we're looking at executive action, most of the time we think about an executive order, which is a presidential directive to the bureaucracy to do things. But there's actually multiple kinds of executive actions. There's the executive order. There's a proclamation. Most of these are ceremonial in nature, like today's the day of X. There are national security directives, which relate, as you would expect, to national security. You've got executive agreements, which are formal agreements between nations that sidestep the Senate's treaty-making power. You've got a memoranda, which is a policy directive that functions like an executive order, but is not published in the Federal Register as a act.
Okay.
You have things like the signing statements where presidents say, here's how I interpret what the law that Congress has passed. You've got executive privilege, which is the right to confidentiality among advisors so that they get all the information they need to make decisions. So it's actually rather broader than executive orders.
Well, that just makes things a little more confusing then. Now, you're the one who you're the one who teaches the class on the politics and government of the United States. Not me. So it's been a while since I've had this, but
sure.
From my understanding of the Constitution, a lot of this sounds like Congress stuff. Where does this power come from?
Well, okay, that's a great question there. And the thing we have to remember is that this executive power is a result of the institutional structure and formal rules of the presidency. So most presidential action is prompted, recognized, and legitimized by constitutional vestments and statutory delegations. Mm-hmm. So they rely on constitutional vestments like commander-in-chief for national security directives. The take care clause is what Trump is relying a lot upon. Trump's also relying a lot on the vesting clause, which says all executive power is vested in the president. Mm-hmm. And so they use what are some vague and general ideas. And since they are ambiguous, this ambiguity begets discretion, which allows presidents to fill in the gaps in the language to claim more power. And what's key with this is for the president to be prevented from using this power, Congress has to step in and stop it. But the president is one person, can act, they can act quickly. For Congress to act to try to stop it, they have to get 218 in the House to agree to it, 60 in the Senate, and then those two bodies have to agree, and then potentially they have to be able to override a presidential veto to stop that. So the idea is presidents are constantly trying to increase their power, and once one president has claimed an authority, other presidents are going to claim that and try to build upon it.
Okay. Now, is this new?
No. Yeah. This goes back to the first president. I mean, when we look at President Washington. He was the first one to claim executive privilege by not turning over notes to the Jay Treaty. He also issued a neutrality proclamation. And there have been other great executive actions we've heard of. The Louisiana Purchase, the Emancipation Proclamation, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, Johnson's establishment of affirmative action requirements for federal contractors, which Trump repealed, even things like George Bush's declaration of enemy combatants and creating military commissions to try people. So, I mean, these are things that have gone on a lot. I mean, President Obama said pass a law, but if not, I have a pen and a phone, and I'll use it to accomplish things. Or as former Bill Clinton advisor Paul Begala said, stroke of the pen, law of the land. And that's kind of the importance of, or the power of an executive action.
So is this something that's changed over time? I mean, you've demonstrated that this has been done throughout our history. Is this changing, though? Is it being used more or less lately?
Yeah,
or what's going on?
I think we see it being used more, and that is basically because of polarization. The thing we have to remember is that an executive action on some level is a sign of weakness because it means they can't get a law passed. And so what they are doing is they're using executive action to communicate to the public and to their supporters, here, I'm taking action to make your life better, or I am fulfilling my campaign promises, or I am advancing the ideological goals that you want. And the thing with this is it has some power, but remember, it's only temporary. Everything Trump's doing is with a stroke of a pen. A new president can come in and can change everything. Just like I think one of the first things Trump did was sign an executive order that repealed 93 Biden executive actions. And so a law is always better than an executive action, but laws require negotiation and compromise. It means you won't get everything you want. And in a polarized politics, you're unlikely to get everything you want. So why not try with executive action?
So is that relative permanence the main difference between a law and an executive action?
Well, that and a executive action is going to be more likely to be subject to litigation.
Right.
Because the question is, does the president have the exact power to do what the president is claiming that he can do?
I mean, what are some of the limits on the president's power? Because this seems pretty expansive.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's for... That's why the courts are playing such a large role in what this is, because Congress struggles to restrict it. Their primary power to do this is through the budget power. They could try to pass a law, but what president's going to sign a bill that overturns his power? The last time we had actually retrenched presidential power was post-Watergate, when there was a congressional and national concern about the power of the president in foreign affairs and in domestic affairs, where they passed the War Powers Resolution to restrict the president's power of sending the military into force, which, by the way, didn't work, and the impoundment power, which is what Trump is challenging here. And part of what we also see is this change in how we view presidential power. Originally, there was the constitutional theory, which the president only carries out what Congress has decided, which makes the president rather passive. With Teddy Roosevelt, he came up with the stewardship theory, that the president can do anything in the public interest as long as it's not forbidden by Congress or the Constitution. And then you have people like Woodrow Wilson, who said our separation of power systems is the problem. That's why we can't achieve progressive governance. And so he wanted a stronger president, to where the president would take these vague ideas of what the public wants and interpret it on their behalf on what they want through strong executive action, which has been followed up by FDR, LBJ, every president since. And as George Will said, progressives got the powerful president they want, but with the president that they abhor.
Sure.
And that's that's kind of the concern about war, or the big concern with this is we're increasing presidential power. Is this good
so
or
that is what
bad?
We're doing. It's fair to say that the president is becoming more powerful over time.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the thing is, because Congress is more concerned about partisan wins than institutional prerogatives.
Right.
So the Democrats who are complaining about everything that President Trump did, well, they were silent or praised it when Joe Biden did things like require mandate COVID vaccines, try to forgive student loans, and a whole host of other things. And while the Republicans complained about this, they're silent or they're cheering what's going on now. And this undermines our separation of power systems, which is a major concern.
So is this bad for democracy?
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, okay. It's not as easy as we say. As long as they presidents are trying to advance things that are in the public interest, which kind of moves us a little bit forward in responding to what the people want, then that's democratic in a way. It's a problem in that our constitutional system is not working, and it's because the political actors are not willing to do what's necessary for the system to work, and that's what makes it a threat to democracy. Because, as you know, one of the main democratic norms is institutional restraint.
That's right.
And we are getting rid of all institutional restraint on the executive branch, and that is what is a threat to constitutional governance. It's also a threat to liberal democracy. It may reflect more democracy doing what the majority wants, but liberal democracy is the idea of majority rule that protects minority rights, and the concern is we're running over minority rights. What I would also say is most of what the presidents are doing is not majority rule, it's doing what a minority wants, so it's minority rule. But since you've got cheerleaders in Congress behind it, they're not going to stop it. And it's both undemocratic under democracy. It's also contrary to constitutional governments under liberal democracy.
Sure. So do you see this as part of that landscape of illiberal democracy that people see in other countries as well, or is this a uniquely American thing?
I don't think we're at illiberal democracy yet.
Okay.
But I think we're potentially going down that road because we are giving the executive more power.
Sure.
And so in this regard, I'm going to say this is one of the good things about what the Supreme Court has been doing over the past 6-7 years is that they are restricting executive discretion. Now we see on the one hand that the Supreme Court probably supports the unitary theory, which is the conservative version of the Woodrow Wilson progressive presidency idea, that the president interprets the idea. The unitary theory is the idea that the all executive power is vested in a president. And so it's the idea that all executive power is vested in the president. The idea is all subordinate executive officials are removable at will by president because they're supposed to do what the president wants.
Yeah.
The president can take the president's take care duty entails an exclusive power to decide which laws to enforce or not enforce. And the idea that POTUS can direct and control all subordinate officials. So that's where you get things like the immunity decision, where the president has cannot be prosecuted for things that are done for policy purposes, but they can for personal purposes. But the concern with even the unitary theory is does it really give the president that much power overall, because mm-hmm. we also have to remember, while the president is the executive, Congress creates the executive departments and determine what they can do. So can that gets to the idea of the president may be in charge of personnel, but there is restricted discretion
mm-hmm.
in what the executive officials can do. And there would be concerns about, can you actually not enforce what the law is, though recent presidents have chosen to enforce and not enforce things depending upon what favors them politically.
Okay.
So the idea hopefully is, if the Supreme Court allows personnel control, then they're going to be much more restrictive on what the president can do. So that's things like the major questions doctrine that says mm-hmm. when you're making a big change in policy, Congress has to step in and improve that. And even things like getting rid of Chevron mm-hmm. deference, which is the idea, as long as the agency is interpreting something reasonably, it will be upheld, to no, you have to actually follow what the law is, because what we saw is one president interpreted it one way, the next president interpreted mm-hmm. another, and that's contrary to the rule of law, which implies stability, and the law should not change depending upon who the president is. And so the big question is then, how much will we restrict what an executive can do?
Sure. So if the power of the executive as an office seems to be getting stronger, you're saying maybe some of the executive agencies have perhaps less power under this? Or how does that work? Because I'm still feeling a little constitutionally queasy based on what you've been telling
me. Yeah. Yes. So, yes, I think that is the case, to where the Supreme Court might be more, you have to have its more express mm-hmm. authority from Congress to do something. And
okay.
if you don't have that, we're not going to imply based on this. So the idea, the Biden administration took things from like the Clean Water Act from the 1970s. Well, in fact, the Obama and Biden administration said that, to say we can regulate emissions from utilities and other kinds mm-hmm. of things, when that would be a huge regulatory endeavor, in which case, can the president make that decision based on something that was passed 50 years ago that no president claimed they had the right to until they decided, oh, we want to do this?
Right. So you talked a lot about the Supreme Court in this, but you know, some lower courts have been pretty active in this process. In fact, several of Trump's executive actions and orders have been blocked by judges. So how can judges do that? What's the legal process, first of all? And then what does it look like for it to be successfully blocked? Because most of these things seem to be freezes or temporary pauses.
Yes.
Or how does this work?
So what most of the time is that they are going is they are asking a judge to freeze an action pending a full hearing.
Mm.
So the idea is they're asking for a temporary injunction, because if it goes through before the court hears it, it could have dramatic effects. So for example, eliminating the USAID. Okay,
mm-hmm.
the idea, we're gonna hold that because we have to think through a lot of issues first. And so what you see at times is the judges issuing injunctions which are basically overly broad,
mm-hmm.
and then they get response and they tend to narrow it a little bit, but then they have to hold a hearing and then decide whether to move forward. So for example, a court basically put an injunction on the buyout proposal
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
Musk and Trump have been promoting, but he released it yesterday because he eventually decided that the employees union did not have standing to challenge
okay.
that. But what that means is they'll find someone who doesn't want to take that, but may be forced to challenge it. And so
right.
then at that point, a new judge might implement a freeze.
So these freezes are done based on pending legislation. mostly. Not legislation, sorry, litigation.
Right. But they have to make the argument that, A, it's contrary to federal law in some way to even get a temporary injunction.
Okay. So some of these executive actions have been a little bit confusing to me in terms of priority or authority or things like that. So maybe I'm just going to fire a few at you and you tell me what you think about how it works and why it's that way. So
okay.
Let's start with renaming bodies of water. We have the Gulf of Mexico, and apparently now it is the Gulf of America. And if I open Google right now, it says Gulf of America on that. If I open Google Maps.
Yeah. So,
yeah, so what happened? How does that work?
This is the president having an executive action directing the people who make the maps to make that change.
Okay, and he can do this.
It's happened, yes.
Yeah. So is this something where we didn't know if he could do it till he tried and now he can? Or?
Well, originally the things I heard was that he was going to have to make a few more appointments to a board which makes these decisions, but he's basically issued the directive, and whether the agency has made that decision, Google is going along with it. And you even saw yesterday where the AP reporter has lost his place at the White House because AP refers to it as the Gulf of Mexico still. But the question is, how will everyone else around the world view? Will they change it? Or will people start saying Gulf of America instead of Gulf of Mexico?
Okay, so it's still not extremely clear to me how he has this, but I guess it makes sense. It's strategy, it's politics, it's caring a lot about the name of the Gulf.
Yes.
So let's do another one then. Can he end birthright citizenship? What happens there?
Absolutely not. I mean, that one has no chance at all. For this one, it violates the plain meaning of the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
Two, the Supreme Court has held people born here, unless they're like a foreign diplomat or something, are subject to the jurisdiction thereof, and are citizens under U.S. versus Wu Kim Long, Wong, or I'm blanking on the case, but something like that. And even if you look at that, the president cannot make a unilateral determination. If anyone can change that, it would be Congress, because Article 1 gives the naturalization authority to Congress, not to the president. So he's got no chance of winning that.
There's multiple problems with that one.
With him declaring that.
Sure. So that's why that one is a much more tenuous proposition, and yet I opened the Maps app and the Gulf has changed.
Yes.
Okay. So what about issuing a tariff? How can he issue a 25, or I don't know what it was, a tariff on steel and aluminum across the board as president?
Yeah, okay. So that, I think, is going to be a little bit more challenging with that. So what he has been using is a International Emergencies Act, which has typically been used to apply sanctions to nations we have problems with. So, for example, that was probably used to apply sanctions against Russia.
Right.
So what he is doing is using this to say, for national security reasons, i.e. fentanyl, then I am applying these sanctions on allies or Canada and Mexico. With this, since this is a novel way of using the IEEA, I think that's the law he's using, that could be subject to challenge. And then he's talking about a policy of reciprocal tariff agreements. I think that would probably run afoul of the major questions doctrine, because Congress has the power to lay tariffs, and for Trump to create a new system without congressional action, I think would be very problematic.
Okay, but it seems like a lot of these things are problematic, and some go through and some don't. I mean, how can we tell which ones are going to work and which ones aren't?
Okay, so here's one rule of thumb that I saw Yuval Levin say. If it's about personnel, it favors the president. So the president commands the executive branch, but the president does not command the system of governance.
Mm.
So if he tries to do something which is potentially in the realm of Congress or the courts or someone else, then that's likely to fail. And so I think that's why some of his actions with tariffs could potentially be problematic. I think his shutting down agencies could be problematic by basically firing all the employees of an agency, mm-hmm. or the idea of not spending money that Congress has appropriated, because the appropriation bills mm-hmm. says this, the president shall, or this agency shall. Right. Shall's not may. Shall means you have to spend it. So I think the impoundment would be very constitutionally suspect.
Okay. That makes sense as a rule of thumb. As we think about this from a Christian perspective, what things should we be thinking about with regard to these executive orders? Because some of this is just policy decisions, and some of this is a bunch of legal jargon where we have to decide what fits and doesn't under the constitutional order. But how should we approach this as Christians?
Well, there's a couple of ways. First, what I've already referred to is the idea that we are fallen people. Mm-hmm. We should be concerned about vesting a large degree of power in any one person. Hmm. And so I think we need to be concerned about how this executive authority can be used. That doesn't mean it's the actions he takes are wrong, mm-hmm. but we should always be skeptical of a new claim of executive authority. Because remember, the president is one person. They can act quickly. They have access to information that everyone else does not have, which they can hide, and they can claim national security to justify an awful lot of things, which can eventually impinge upon our freedoms. The second thing I would say with this is we need to remember the best way to resolve our problems is not through unilateral action, but discussion and negotiation. Mm. I look at the Council of Jerusalem as a good example of this. They had a problem. They discussed it. They came to a solution. I think what this means is we need to use Congress more. Mm. I think the whole point of our Constitution is to ensure that narrow majorities do not impose their will on the country at large. The idea of passing laws is to ensure that narrow majorities have to broaden themselves before they can actually act. And I think that's what the idea of getting 218 people together from distinct districts together have to agree with a majority of the states, and really 60% of the Senate due to the filibuster, which, while not constitutional, in our polarized society is something we should all support to make sure no one side gets everything they want, and to force negotiation and compromise. Because I think that's the best way to get greater legitimacy for what we're doing. But I think this also means, as members of Congress, we need to be thinking more about passing laws than stopping everything that's done. But that means one side needs to say, okay, you can do stuff, but the other side needs to say, we're going to negotiate with you because we're going to recognize that 60 vote margin in the Senate, right, especially means we're going to have to compromise with you. And the other thing I would say with this, in a democracy, you may win 50% of the vote, but the other side may get 49%. They deserve a right to influence government too. And I think that's what we are preventing the other side to do. Whenever we're in power, we want our side to govern, but not the other. But we're a 50-50 nation. Trump won 49-48. The Democrats have a role in governing in this, just like when Biden won, he may have had 51%, but Republicans won 47%. They deserved a large say in what goes on, too.
Well, you have tough prescriptions for these problems, because these are the same things that you said at the beginning are the things that, because we can't do them, we have executive action. So is this just a tough thing to untangle? Or
yes. Yeah. No, I mean, there's no easy solution to this, but it's going to require people to realize that the Constitution matters more than their personal power and their personal policy interest. And right now, I just don't see that happening. Wow. I'll go further with this. When we look at the Constitution, the founders thought that auxiliary precautions were necessary to keep government in line, i.e. the separation of powers. But what they also thought was virtue was important in making sure that people exercise the self-restraint necessary for our system to work. What we have seen is that virtue is declining, which allows people to do whatever they want. They're going to follow their desires, their appetites. They're not going to see a problem with acting irresponsibly. Mm. And I think when virtue begins to decline, I think that's when people will abuse their power, that they lose any sense of institutional restraint. And I think that's when democracy is at threat.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. There's so much more I want to talk about this. We haven't even touched on the DOGE agency or Elon Musk's attempt to reform the bureaucracy. But in the interest of the idea that self-restraint and moderation are virtues, perhaps we should cut ourselves off at this tidy half hour. So thank you so much for your thoughts on this and your insight, Sean. But with that, I will yield the remainder of my time.